did a good job at that. That's exactly how I wrote that. Thanks. I'm a slowly recovering Al-Anon. My name is Rick Chatuk. Good evening, everybody.
Hi, Rick!
And as they say in Omaha, Nebraska, by the grace of God, in a program called the 12 Steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, a fellowship called the Al-Anon Family Group, and the loving but very firm guidance of a big book, Black Belt Al-Anon sponsor. It's not been necessary for me to plan any kind of death, yours or mine, since the 10th day of April, 1987. And for that, I'm extremely grateful. It's really, really nice to be here with you in this enthusiastic event. I appreciated getting the invitation. Richard, thank you for coming to get me at the airport. It's the second chance I've had to be here in Saskatoon with you. I must say, when I was here before, or a number of years back, it was the coldest I've ever been in my existence. And I tell that story all the time. So I went to this place where, and the meeting was on a Sunday morning. And I thought, who in their right mind is going to come out in this temperature at an AA conference to hear an Al-Anon talk at 10 o'clock in the morning? I thought I'd be talking to the hotel staff. And everybody came. And I thought, you know what, you guys really need a program. What the hell are you doing here in this temperature to hear an Al-Anon on a Sunday morning? But it was a good time. My hometown is Toronto, Ontario, and my home group is the St. Clair Al-Anon Family Group. We meet in the church hall of Holy Rosary Catholic Church, which is located on the north side of St. Clair Avenue, situated between Spadina Avenue and Bathurst. Meet every Tuesday night at 8 o'clock. Anybody's in town would like to come to a meeting on a Tuesday night, I'd love to host you. It'd be great to have you and join us. I was delightful to get the invite from Richard. He tracked me down somehow. I had no idea that my name was on the internet as much as he found it. That is very scary. He knows everything about me more than I thought I even knew. All kinds of work things and program things. It's pretty amazing. But he's been a delightful host, as has Karen been, and I appreciate them having me in their home and giving me a nice bed to sleep in and two cats and a dog. Just delightful. I love cats, and they have the cutest dog ever. Fabulous little dog. I really had a good weekend. I've enjoyed the speakers. Ben, I really enjoyed your sharing last night. I identified with a lot of what you had to share. And Judy, that was terrifically powerful this afternoon. And Randy, absolutely bang on. It was just a treat to hear messages of that caliber and sharing that's that honest. It really fills me up. So it really has been a great weekend up to this point, and I hear the dance is going to be great, so let's just get through this hour and we'll be fine. I do want to thank Richard for really having the most unique card at the airport. I've been to the airports a lot where people kind of stand around, and the oddest one I had one time was a guy was holding up a blank piece of cardboard because my name was on the side facing him. I'd like to tell you that was in the United States. It was in Vancouver. You're from Canada. Come on, turn it around. But this one is the very first time I've ever had one in color with my name actually printed on the poster. So you can tell that your speaker person has some connection to the printing industry. And he's asked me to announce that at the end of the meeting, actually starting tomorrow morning, if you just call up www.richardandkaren, you will be able to find the Journey to Serenity collection. And so they offer a fine line of posters and sign-up sheets, name tags, balloons, and, like nothing I've ever seen, imprinted bags for the raffle. These are all available for a nominal fee starting tomorrow morning at www.richardandkaren.com. We have this odd thing that we have to do in Al-Anon. They ask us to qualify. So the third tradition says, the only requirement for membership, there'd be a problem with alcoholism or relative or friend, because as we all know, anybody can join AA, but you have to know someone to get into Al-Anon. And It is an exclusive club.
And I've known five,
just for your information. Two of them by birth, and more important and certainly more germane to the sharing I have to do with you tonight, three by choice. Of those three alcoholic women that I've chosen, I met two of them in Al-Anon. They didn't even quite know they had a problem with alcohol. I did. And it was delightful. I don't understand. There's some things I don't understand about the alcoholic. Like it's just so weeny to drink. You know, like it's there and then it's gone. You go buy some more and it's gone. Like there's absolutely nothing like having an alcoholic woman in your life to keep you going 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, every day of the month, all year. They're just there constantly. And if you're the kind of guy like me that just kind of needs to have that, it's a terrific thing. So I pick alcoholic women out very, very well. I've seen a few of you here tonight. Even if you don't know. Even if you don't know it, I'm going to have a little radar. Hello, hello, hello. Hello. So I'd just like to let you know that if you are here tonight and you're female and you're in Al-Anon, and if you're wondering, you know, I wonder if I have a problem with alcohol, I'd just like to tell you, ignore any questions that anybody in Alcoholics Anonymous is going to present to you. Simply come up to me after this meeting and ask me this simple question. Do you find me attractive? And if the answer is yes, run like hell to the other side. They can really help you, because you're not going to find what you need here. Anyhow, isn't it so beautiful to laugh? How long did we cry? How long were we bottled up? How long did we sit alone, even when there were people in the room, alone, and not know how to get that out? How long did we times when we could only laugh at something that happened to somebody? And here we can laugh at what happened to us. We can laugh at what we do, because what we do is hilarious. We don't drink, and we do the oddest goofball thing known to man. The problem with me is not an alcoholic, and it's not alcoholism. I'm not here because of an alcoholic, and I've known, like I told you, I know those five of them. And I'm not here because they drink. I'm here because of something that I do. And that's the key part of the message I would really like to share with you tonight. And that's why the program called the 12 Steps of AA work for those of us who are members of this fellowship called the Al-Anon Family Groups, including Alateen. I have no memory of a time before alcoholism. It's been there forever. I have no memory of a time of ever looking at the end of my arm and not seeing my hand. And there's never been a time when I've looked at the bottom of my leg and not seen a foot. It's omnipresent in my life. And alcoholism is the same way. Nobody was purposely alcoholic. Nobody was doing that stuff to me. Nobody ever woke up one day and said, I'm going to go out and get drunk and come home and terrorize my family tonight. I don't believe that ever happened. But I knew, though, that there's just people that have a disease in my family. Lots of them. The two closest to me are my father, who's still alive, and my grandmother who died. An alcoholic death. You ever seen anybody die who had sclerosis? It's like put four or five balloons. It was amazing just to witness that. My grandmother was from Scotland, from Glasgow. And in the last 10 years of her life, she owned a great big old house in the east part of Toronto, in a place called Pickering, a 13-room old hotel house. And she had it moved back when the city expropriated her land. And from the time they moved it back, they built a new foundation, a new basement, put the house on it. From the time she moved back in to the time she died was 10 years. And there was a liquor store across the street. And she lived in this massive old building by herself. And every day would be seen trundling from this scary, spooky old house over to the liquor store with one of those little metal carry things, filling it up with sherry and bringing it back. And spent the last 10 years of her life drinking. But she never threw anything away, especially the bottles. So when she died, it was my job to clean 10 years worth of empty bottles out of her basement. It took me and my father a day and a half to break them all. We put them into boxes, broken glass, put it in a van, and drove the van to a glass recycling plant. They measured the van, they weighed the van when we went in, we unloaded the glass, and they weighed the van when we came out. They pay you $25 a ton for glass, and I got $50 in 10 years. And that was the mother of my father. And for years when I was hanging around in this fellowship, I had the gall to blame him for being a bad father. To blame him for everything that happened to me. Because you see, if it hadn't been for him, I would have turned out better. But take a look at what he grew up with. And take a look at what she grew up with. Another one like that. Because the disease of alcoholism is what affects us. It's not the person. It's not the alcoholic. It's the alcoholism that affects the family. It's a disease spreading itself all over that affects us. And it affected me in all kinds of ways. I did odd little things as a kid. I was nervous all the time. I was throwing up all the time. I spent all kinds of time in the bathroom because it was a safe place to go. I peed a lot just because I had a nervous bladder. I would love to hide in my closet. I would clean all the clothes out of my closet and put them on my bed, and I'd put a little table inside the closet, and I'd get bring in a little chair, and I'd hang a light over the bar that holds the clothes. And I'd write a little sign that said, "Keep out!" And I'd paste it on the outside of the door. And I would go inside the closet and close the door and wonder why nobody had come in. Or I would get a fort. I'd build a fort in my basement and do the same thing, saying, "Keep out," and go inside where it was safe and wonder why nobody would come in. And that is a fantastic metaphor for my adult life. Because I was no longer hiding in closets. I'm finally out. Ta-da! And I no longer build forts and put up signs. But in what ways would I use my body posture and my eyes and my language and my withdrawing to say to you, "Keep out"? Because underneath, the deepest part of me was screaming, "Come in. Come in." But I was, at that time in my life, incapable of allowing someone in. And that was that's where I was when I came back to Al-Anon in 1987. My mother got worried about me because I was peeing all the time and I was throwing up all the time and just doing all these weird kind of things and seeking attention and doing just becoming like a young little vandal because I couldn't get any kind of attention at school for doing anything good, so I got it for just being a little PR. And it worked for a while. Whatever you need to do to fill that gap, whatever that space is inside us, I'm sure you guys have it in Saskatoon, I sure had it in Toronto. You know, there's that gap inside, or at least it's the belief that there's a gap. I understand today that there never was one. I just believe that there was one. God was there all the time. I just was never able to see that He was there for me. My mother got really quite concerned about her son, and so she brought me to the doctor and gave me a test. It's like kind of an allergy test, I think, and they put little pinpricks up my arms and all across my shoulders and down my arm and did all kinds of other things, urine tests and whatever. And when the results came back, they all came back negative. And the doctor said, "Mrs. Jatuk, there's absolutely nothing wrong with your son." But here I was, nervous all the time, hiding in the bathroom, getting away from people as much as I could, hiding in my closet, peeing and throwing up all the time, couldn't stomach any kind of food. There was something going on. Now, there was no test for what I had. As a matter of fact, there's no test for what I have to this very day. Because the disease that my mother's son was suffering from at that young age and the disease that my mother's son suffers from today is called alcoholism, the family disease. I do not drink. I don't drink alcoholically. But I have a disease called alcoholism, the family disease. And that is why the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous work for a guy like me. Nobody ever asked, "Is there any drinking going on at home?" But there was. And there was a lot of drinking going on at home. I'm not going to regale you, as much as I love to do it, regale you with stories of what they did. But I will tell you just one thing that kind of is a little bit of an illustration of who I was and who we were as a family in the midst of some of all of that craziness. My dad loved to do three things. My father loved to drink, he loved to garden, and he loved to take off his clothes. And as y'all know, Canada gets pretty cold in the winter, but in the summer it's pretty warm. Even in Saskatoon, when I was flying in, I saw pools. I thought, in Saskatoon? It's amazing. They have swimming pools in their backyard. So I guess it gets warm here. I've just never been here when it's hot. Wait me in the summer, I'll find it. But it gets really warm in Toronto. If you're at the International, you know. I mean, it gets hot. And so my dad would start gardening in the backyard. And he'd start drinking first thing in the morning, and he'd start in the backyard and digging away, and as it got hotter during the day, the clothes would start to come off. And he was getting drunker, and we had this beautiful-looking flower bed in the backyard. And by about midday, he was out front. And by then, he hadn't totally disrobed. But he, if you can imagine this, Bermuda shorts turned into a thong. And there's the image. Beer belly, cigarette, bottle of beer, and the physique of a full-blown beer-drinking alcoholic. And at that time, nobody was afraid of getting sun, like skin cancer from sun. So my dad didn't put any suntan lotion on. He put on oil to attract the sun into this big frame. I can just envision my mother, you know, standing in the front window looking out at this hunk that she once married. You get in here now. I want you. Cigarette, beer bottle, dirt on his hands, greased up belly, Bermuda shorts. Now he's out there, and my dad also had an anger problem, and we're inside like hiding our face, and every once in a while we had a guy in the street who would race a car up and down or a motorcycle up and down, and it would piss him off. And so one day he finally got to him, and he went running after the guy. And he got him. And the street kind of gathered around, and he started chewing this guy out. Beer belly, lathered up, Bermuda shorts into a thong. And there he is out there making an ass of himself, and we're inside, and we can't show our face. And isn't that one of the classic symptoms of alcoholism, the family disease? That they're out there doing it, we are ashamed. We're not doing anything, but we're ashamed because of what they do. Years later, I'm happy to tell you that he got the cure. Went to AA. Beautiful thing. And he really got the cure. The bumper stickers, the whole 9 yards. And my mother says to my father one day, Donald, for God's sake, why do you have those bumper stickers on the back of the car? Everyone's going to see them. I said, Mom, they've seen everything else. But isn't that, it's the exact same coin flipped around. We don't want them, they're out there making an ass of themselves. We don't want to show our face. He's in recovery. We don't want anybody to know. Now, this is a home where every once in a while you'd wake up and all the contents of the inside were on the front lawn because of an event that had happened the evening before in some kind of drunken escapade. This is the kind of home where the car would sometimes be parked on the front lawn. This is the kind of house that had a drunk sitting out at midnight throwing tea bags at stray cats. And we, true, are not making it, you can't make this up. Really. If you made it up, people would think it's not made up. There he is. Because they were pooping in his garden. The keen alcoholic mind. He took my pellet gun out one time to shoot them. And he missed. Dad, go back to the tea bags.
Okay.
it's insane. Insane what goes on in these homes. So anyhow, you know, we don't want anybody to know when they're doing it, and then they get better. We don't want anybody to know. We don't want anybody to know. A beautiful thing happened around 1967. My mother went to Al-Anon, and still to this day is a member of Al-Anon. Next calendar year, she'll be a 40-year Al-Anoner. Pretty good. Pretty good. Last April, for the very first time, my mother and I spoke at a convention together. She did Friday, I did Saturday. It was gorgeous. I loved it. She did a great job. Really, really loved it. Anyhow, in 1967, my mother went to Al-Anon. And in 1968, there was an Alateen conference coming to Toronto. And the Alateens needed, this was before the guidelines, this is when you could do stuff like this. The Alateens were looking for homes for the Alateens who were coming from out of town to stay in. And so my mother knew she had this wonky little kid at home, me. And so she said, so they're saying, you know, we need places for the Alateens to stay. So into this active alcoholic home, my mother said, I'll take three. So in 1968, at the young age of 11 years old, goofy little kid that I was, into my front door walked three people from Kalamazoo, Michigan, who are in Alatine. And that was my first encounter with this stunningly beautiful fellowship. And what happened to me that day was remarkable to me, but to anybody observing, it was so normal. And three teenagers and me, I was 11, we were just kind of standing around in the hall, and then we were sitting around in the rec room chatting. And I didn't say much, but I was listening. But for the first time in my young life, I felt this marvelous feeling of belonging. That it's simply okay to be here. And in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, I feel the same thing today. Because you are my people. We understand at the cellular level what it is like to live with alcoholism, what it is like to be affected by alcoholism, what it is like to live a life as family members of alcoholics. We understand that. And I need to be with people like you, who when I share with you the deepest and innermost part of what I went through, how I recovered, you kind of go, yeah. Try sharing some of this stuff to the people at work. They go, you're a sick bastard. And that doesn't make me feel good. But I share it with you and you go, yeah, I get it. I understand. And I need that aha. I need that yes. So I went to an Alatine conference there in 1968 and I started going to an Alatine. And it was a fantastic thing. And they gave me some real good lessons in Alatine. They said this fabulous thing to me that I needed to hear at the young age of 11 and then into 12. And they said, Rick, your father is an alcoholic. He is not a bad man. Listen to that. I thought he was a bad man. That's the way it was portrayed to me all the time. Because before my mother went at Al-Anon, she needed someone to talk to. And I was the guy. Son, sit down. So I became a 7-year-old counselor, 9-year-old therapist, 10-year-old sex therapist. I heard it all. I knew it all. I saw it all because she needed someone to talk to. Now, that wasn't anything she was doing to me. That is what disease does to people. Nobody was choosing to do that. Nobody chooses disease. But disease comes in, and that is part of some of the manifestation that happened in my home around alcoholism, the family disease. So they said, Rick, your father is an alcoholic. He is not a bad man. He has a disease. He is not a disgrace. What a beautiful thing to know and to hear. And I hung out in Alatine and stayed in Alatine until I was 21. They kicked me out. It was a beautiful thing. I met a lot of great friends, traveled all over the darn place. You know, it was terrific. Kind of went through all the most active drinking years with my dad until I was 18 and he got sober. And hey, that's a good event. I'll tell you, I'll take a dry one over a wet one any day. But it didn't mean that life at home just got magically better. But it did mean that there wasn't any more of that active, wet, alcoholic insanity. And that is a good thing. The violence was over. And that was a really good thing. And so I was 21 years old. I loved Alatine. And they said, Rick, you got to go. I said, I don't want to go. And they said, you can't be an Alatine and be bald and have a beard. It really is time. It is time to move on, buddy. I had done Alatine Fellowship really well, and I learned all the words. You know, like I shared a bit in that workshop I did this afternoon. Thanks again for asking me to do that. I really did enjoy it. I didn't quite know what your reaction was, but I sure did enjoy having the opportunity to share about that stuff. So anyhow, I went out and I found an Al-Anon harem. And so I found this lovely group that had about a dozen women in it, you know, and they kind of knew me as that cute guy from Alatine. And so I kind of hung around with these old ladies, these women for a while. Blue hair, knitting, you know. Boy, I really identify with this. I'm 21, just starting to feel it. And yes, I'm going to this meeting with these blue-haired, knitting old women. Yeah, boy, this is doing it for me, pal. If you want what we got, keep coming back. I don't want what you got, but I'm keeping coming back anyway. But, you know, like, I really wasn't getting better. I was just kind of doing this fellowship deal. I'd read my book every once in a while. But, you know, I really wasn't getting it. And I was starting to grow up, and there were more things that were starting to happen inside me, because I really, when I was an Alatine, focused on just this alcoholic and kind of living and dealing with that. And that was, I needed to do that. And the program teaches us so well how to deal with that stuff, how to live with that stuff, how to understand that stuff. We are beautiful at doing that. But I never really internalized that there was anything wrong with me. It was all still very externally focused. That really, well, you know, yeah, I say I have a problem, but it's really him. It really is. So I kind of hung around Al-Anon for a while, and when a guy had come into our meeting, I'd kind of reach out my hand and say, "Hi, welcome." And my eyes would say, "Get lost. This is my harem." I became very, very protective of these women. They became very protective of me. But after hanging out there for about 6 years, I met somebody who was phenomenally more exciting than any of them, and I left. And so I stopped coming to Al-Anon. And that's really where I want to truly begin this journey of insanity, with sharing this with you. Because you see, I really believe that if we are to recover in Al-Anon, as members of this fellowship, we need to practice a program. And we need to practice those 12 steps. I needed to. And I can't just do that on the surface level. When we come to Al-Anon, we're drawn by many things. The most common story is, they are drinking, how do I get them to fix it? Our PR material says the same. If your home is unhappy because someone drinks too much, we can help you. Excellent! You go into the meeting and say, how do we get them to stop drinking? And I'll be just fine, thank you very much. And this is the Al-Anon con, by the way. Take a look at our posters. You know, is alcoholism a problem in your home? Yeah, come to Al-Anon. We want you. And they come in, and we want to talk about them and him and what they did. And what we say is, no, we don't talk about them. Well, this is false advertising. Well, not really. We believe that we have a problem. The only problem I have is him. Thank you very much. I'm the one keeping this together. I'm the one that everybody came to asking me for advice. The father, the mother, the sister came to me looking for advice. How can I have the problem? I'm the one telling them how to fix their problems. I'm good at it. I like it. And you're telling me that I got a problem? You're wrong. But you weren't wrong. Because we come in on this side. And this is the tough thing for us. Because the qualification to get here is that there be a problem there. The only requirement for membership is that there be a problem of alcoholism in a relative or friend. Somebody else. Not me. Our qualification doesn't say the only reason, you know, the only qualification to be here is that your life is totally messed up. Doesn't say that. Should, but it doesn't. So we come in here externally focused, looking at someone else, and then we start to do our deal. We start to do what we do. And some of us do it, and some of us don't, and I'm one of those that didn't. I never crossed. I never truly crossed from the side that said, it's him. To the side that said, oh my God, it's me. I never did it. But I loved hanging out in Al-Anon, and I loved hanging out in Malachi. It's a great place to be. A lot of good wisdom here, a lot of fun stuff. Kind of use a little bit of it, but I never really, truly, at depth, admitted that I had a problem. Because I believe we do. And I certainly know that I do. And I call it alcoholism, the family disease. In my favorite bit of Al-Anon literature this very day, our old ODAP book, it says this. On March 12th, it says, the longer I am in Al-Anon, the more clearly I perceive that alcoholism is indeed a sickness, a compulsion, and obsession. But haven't I, too, been afflicted with a sick compulsion? Wasn't I determined to save the alcoholic, and that to the same degree as he was addicted to alcohol? Was that not my mission? If we really do want peace of mind, the first thing to realize is that it does not depend on conditions outside us, but those inside us. On July 27th, it said, Al-Anon's prime purpose is to help us deal with the problems that alcoholism has aggravated. And on August 1st, it says, many of our troubles are self-created. Many of our personal agonies, self-inflicted. My sponsor says it this way. Adding an alcoholic to a person like me is like sprinkling Miracle-Gro on your defects. And Bill Wilson wrote a book back in the late 1930s. And at the bottom of page 81, he wrote this. Our design for living is not a one-way street. It is as good for the wife as it is for the husband. In today's language, it is as good for the family member as it is for the alcoholic. The book was published in 1939, so it's safe to say he knew that in 1938. They knew that there was something wrong with us. Am I who I am because of an alcoholic? Or am I with an alcoholic because of who I am? Which way does it go? One of my favorite Al-Anon speakers talks about it like this. She says, if you rate your capacity for having a solid, healthy, honest relationship on a scale of 1 to 10, and you're a 2, you don't pick a 10. You pick another 2. And so I sought out those on like level. That is what I did. I'm not that way because of them. I chose them because of who I am. And that's the key element for me in my recovery. Is truly, truly admitting that I have a problem. Rick J. has a problem called alcoholism, the family disease. And the fantastic news is that there is a way to recover from that. That my father can be alive, he's still alive, but he could be dead. People can be alive or dead, they can be with us, they can be gone, and what is with me is with me. I was affected by a disease, and I became inflicted with one. And when the person who carried the disease is gone, I'm left with it. If somebody gives me a cold and they recover, I still have the cold. And I can't take a pill to help them recover from something they've got. The 12 steps are not for you. I don't do the 12 steps so they will get better. I do the 12 steps so that I can find my God. I do the 12 steps so that I can stand in this world and just feel like I belong there. So if we have a disease, our disease has to have some symptoms. It has to look like something. There are things that we do that are concrete, they are observable, and they are readily identifiable. And so I'm going to let you know what some of those are for me. I'd like to know that I have a timer here, not so much so that I keep me on track, but just so I know when I'm over time for the people doing the CD. I'm 32 minutes in. So there's symptoms. There's symptoms of this disease called alcoholism, the family disease, and I'd like to share with you a few of those for me. One of them is this feeling, and we politely call an Al-Anon, you know, I was a people pleaser. Well, I'd like to let you know that there was never a time in my life that I ever gave a care about pleasing you. Never. Because I was 100% totally self-focused on Rick. However, what I loved was your approval. If I could get you to approve of me, for a brief moment in time, I could feel that I was okay. So I was really never a people pleaser because I didn't care how you felt. I just cared how it affected me. What I really became was an approval sucker. And I would do anything in any way that I could with any person at any given time to whatever level I needed to go to get your approval, because for a brief moment in time, it would allow me to believe things are okay. But then it would go away. Now, I'm not accepting any kind of God into my life when I'm doing this. This is a totally ego-driven thing. This is my solution to that nagging, screaming inside me that says you're weird, ugly, and different. And ask me. That's one of my classic symptoms. Not people-pleaser, but approval sucker. Second thing that we say in Al-Anon all the time is I have low sense of self-esteem. Well, I'm kind of finally happy to say that I've kind of reached low. That's not true. But I think I'm above the low, finally. But low was high from where I started. And so it wasn't just kind of this nebulous, you know, kind of thing. It was very concrete for me about what does low self-esteem look like in my life. And so for me, I had this paranoia about my own image. I loathed going to get my hair cut. There was a time when I had hair. And so when you get your hair cut, you have to sit on a chair, and there's somebody standing behind you, and you're looking at your full face, and they ask you this question. How do you want to look? Well, if you can't stand looking at yourself, you really can't tell anybody this is how I want to look. So I'd screaming inside, saying, like, I just want to disappear. So I'd say something, and I'd cut my hair, and I didn't care how it looked, and I'd run out. For a long time, I would chop at my own hair as an adult man because I wouldn't go to the hairdresser to go to get my hair cut. I loathed having my picture taken. I teach high school. They take your pictures for the yearbook. just a couple of weeks ago, I was moving some books that were on shelves, and I checked the yearbooks for the first 6 years of my teaching career. Every yearbook has a blank spot with my name underneath it. Two university degrees, and I'm afraid to get my hair cut, but I'm afraid to have my picture taken. This is not about intelligence. This is about some other thing going on deep, deep, deep down. If it was a brain problem, if I could think my way out of this, I would have thought my way out of it a long time, and I'd be in trauma. But I'm here because I am incapable of doing this deal by myself. If anybody caught me with a camera, I'd make a funny face because that was a way to hide. I loathe buying a pair of pants. So when you buy pants, you have to look in three mirrors. You can't get away. And that's how some of my low self-esteem manifested itself. I'd walk by a plate glass window in a mall or in a shopping center, full body reflection. I would never look at myself. I couldn't stand it. Now, nobody ever said to me, "Rick, you're dumb, ugly, and stupid." Ever said that. But somewhere along the way, I internalized the message that that was true. Somewhere along the way, I internalized a shame that was part of my DNA. And I don't know where that came from. All I know is that I grew up in alcoholism. And that's one of the things that was the result of that for me. Nobody did that to me. A disease was present, and that's part of my story. But there are other things that I did. And my most favorite one is that I really didn't want anybody to love me. I just wanted somebody to need me. And that's like kind of the number one in my hit parade. And this is how this happened for me. I met a woman. Where is it? These are real pretty, but they're in the way. Anyhow, I found myself, I was in my second year of university, I was a music student. I applied to, I'd done an audition and was accepted to a school in Banff, a fine arts school in Banff. And it was for a program for brass quintets. I played the tuba. And the person that accepted me said, "Why don't you contact the other four members of your group and have a few rehearsals before you go out to the school, so you'll be a little farther ahead when you get to the school to start the program." Great idea. And so I phoned around to three of the other four people, and we made arrangements for practice, and then I phoned her. And I'm here to tell you that these antennae that I have, I don't even have to see you. I can kind of hear your voice and talk to you and go, "Hello." And so I phoned this last person, and what was supposed to be this five-minute little call to arrange a practice turned into like an hour-long lust fest on the telecom. And I was just fascinated by this woman. She had been places I wanted to go, and she played music with people I wanted to play music with. And she had this delightful energy, and it was fantastic. And so we'd arranged rehearsal, but then we started talking on the phone every once in a while, and she started telling me some kind of things like, you know, that there was some violence problems in the home. And little did I know that I was doing this, but on reflection I know that inside I was going, "Really? I can help you with that. I like that." And then one day I'm at work. I have a summer job. I worked in the liquor store. True story. The alcoholic father of a friend of mine in Alateen got me the job. Not making this up. And so on a Saturday afternoon, I'm at the liquor store. This woman that I'd been talking to on the phone phones me up, and she's drunk. She said, "My boyfriend was supposed to come over. He didn't show up. I drank this bottle of wine. Why don't you come on over?" 10 years in Alateen. That's not good. The rest of my body, yes! And inside, "Baby, I can help you with that. I get that one." And so I did some research, you know, I talked around, I asked about her, you know, I am in Allen, and I'm also an excellent researcher. And so I found out great things about her, that she's a terrific trumpet player, still is to this very day, that she's really pretty, and hey, that meant a lot, and that she was really experienced. And that was something that really excited me, because I wasn't particularly experienced. Well, I was experienced, but really just not with other people. I had to do something in that closet. The greatest music in Al-Anon is the laughter of identification. Oh my God. Did he say that? The X-rated tape. So the magic day came, and we were heading off to Banff. And I'm at the airport with my mother and father. You know, my mother on my right side, my dad on the left. You know, the protected little son. And in she came. And guys, she was bouncing. It was gorgeous. She had this beautiful little blue top, and her black hair was glistening, and she had this suitcase in one hand and her trumpets in another. And you know, we just kind of watched her come down the terminal in Toronto. And she stood in front of us, and with all that beautiful, fabulous alcoholic energy, she says, "Hi!" and bent down to put her suitcase. The ice popped right out of my dad's head. My mother grabbed her heart. She, obviously, mild cardiac arrest right there. And I've been in Alateen long enough to know I was about to have a spiritual experience. I'll tell you that. And I'm thinking in my head, closet bedamned. I'm going to find out now. And so away we went. And we got on the airplane, and I ordered a beer. And that's what Al-Anons do. We order a beer. And often at the end of the night, there's still some in the can or in the glass. And she ordered one, and she ordered two. She ended up with five. And if there's anything I say today that you can take to the bank, it's that she had five. Because I have never met an Al-Anon that can't count. We might have lots of problems, but math is not one of them. I still do it.